When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
You're listening ad-free on Wondery Plus. Like many American boys, I played on a youth soccer team. We were called Star Wars because what else would a young boy in 1980 want their team to be called? But I was no six-year-old prodigy. My coach put me at fullback, where I'd often just sit down in the dirt during play and pick weeds or look for ants. I didn't have much aptitude for the game nor any real interest in it. So there'd obviously be no chance in hell that anyone would think that I would want to or be a success at owning a professional soccer team, especially at 6 years old. But that's pretty much exactly what happened at Liverpool Football Club. On today's Saturday Matinee, we bring you an episode from my podcast, Business Movers, that tells the tale of two American businessmen who bought an English Premier League football team but knew nothing about the game, didn't care to learn, and ended up acting like six-year-olds. In 2007, Liverpool FC was a team with potential, on the field and off. The sport was changing with new investment coming in from around the globe, and to compete, Liverpool FC sought new ownership. What they got were Tom Hicks and George Gillette, and a civil war within the club and near bankruptcy to boot. I hope you enjoy. And while you're listening, be sure to search for and follow Business Movers. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. It's the evening of May 25th, 2005, at the Atatürk Stadium in Istanbul, Turkey. In an executive box high above the field, the chairman and majority shareholder of Liverpool Football Club, David Moores, grimaces as the club's chief executive, Rick Perry, turns away from the field, wincing. It's the final of the Champions League, the most prestigious game in the European soccer season. And Liverpool has a famous history in this competition, but so does its opponent tonight, AC Milan. The star-studded Milan team is rated as one of the best in the world. Liverpool is not. The referee blows the whistle for halftime. As the red-shirted Liverpool players trudge off the field, the scoreboard above the stands reads AC Milan 3, Liverpool 0. Rick glances at David.
Well, that didn't go quite according to plan.
David shakes his head.
We've not got close to their number 22. Kaká. Yeah, he's ruining the game. Let's go inside. I can't take more of this.
The two men get up from their seats and retreat into the executive box. Various club officials mill about, picking at food at forlorn tables. David lights a cigar and takes a long puff. Rick just chews his lips.
Kewell's injury didn't help, you know.
No, but Harry's been in and out all season, hasn't he? Can't rely on him. What do you think Rafa's saying to them right now?
Rafael Benitez is Liverpool's manager. Appointed the previous summer, he's led the team to the European Cup final, beating some of the continent's top clubs along the way. But winning tonight seems beyond even his powers. David and Rick continue their commiserations.
I don't think there's anything rescuing us. I mean, 3-0, I mean. Let's just see about an improved performance, something to build on for the next season at least. We'll have to get through the embarrassment of the second half first.
David takes another long drag on his cigar, but then Rick turns. And in the stands behind them, the Liverpool fans have begun to sing.
Hey, David, listen.
"You'll Never Walk Alone" echoes around the arena. For decades, Liverpool fans have chanted this song in times of triumph and disaster alike.
They've not given up, have they?
The two men sit together for a moment, listening to the fans' show of defiance. David's eyes begin to well up with tears.
We may not have the best team in the world, Rick, but those supporters, they deserve everything, don't they?
In the second half of the European Cup Finals, Liverpool did more than just give their fans something to cheer about. They won. And their unlikely victory over one of the best teams in Europe became known as the Miracle of Istanbul. Newspapers around the world named it the greatest cup final of all time. And the dramatic night seemed to return Liverpool to the summit of European soccer. A club that had been drifting, flirting with irrelevance, was suddenly thrust back onto the main stage. But now, David Moores and Rick Perry had to find a way for Liverpool to stay there. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Today, Liverpool Football Club is one of the most famous and successful soccer teams in the world. Founded in 1892, Liverpool has won more major trophies than any other English team, including 19 National League titles and 6 European Cups. Their stadium, Anfield, is a modern 61,000-seat arena, and its players are among the most talented and best paid in the world. But in the early 2000s, Liverpool FC risked sliding into irrelevance. On the field, the team was experiencing its worst extended run in decades. Off the field, its stadium had become antiquated and its operations lackluster. Liverpool was falling behind, and it seemed there was little its owner could do about it. David Moores was rich by most standards. He was the heir to a British gambling and retail firm whose family had owned a stake in Liverpool for decades. But he was just a millionaire in what was becoming a billionaire's business. David simply couldn't afford to buy his team the best players or pay for much-needed upgrades to its stadium. So David began to seek outside investment from men and women with deep enough pockets to match the ambitions of Liverpool's fans. But David's search would lead him to two American businessmen who seemed neither to understand the team they were buying nor even want to. Their disastrous time at Liverpool would spark protests in the streets, a bitter battle in court, and see one of the most historic teams in world soccer flirt with oblivion. This is the first episode in our 4-part series on the battle for Liverpool Football Club, Golden Sky. It's June 2003 in a village 10 miles north of Liverpool, almost 2 years before the miracle of Istanbul. A telephone echoes through the mansion home of Liverpool Football Club chairman David Moores. The 57-year-old pads down the hallway to the ringing phone.
Yeah, hello.
Good morning, David.
David instantly recognizes the voice. It's Rick Perry, Liverpool CEO, and he sounds stressed.
Have you heard the news?
No, what is it?
You buy a television?
Not really. What's going on? Has something happened, Rick?
Well, maybe not. It's just been announced that Chelsea's been sold.
Chelsea Football Club, based in West London, is one of Liverpool's rivals. The club has been in financial trouble for years, and its owner, Ken Bates, has been looking for a buyer.
Oh, Ken's finally found someone to take that money pit off his hands, has he? Well, who's the man who signed his own death sentence?
Some Russian, Roman Abramovich.
Who?
Yeah, that's what everyone's saying. I've got no idea either. He's not involved in the game at all, as far as I can tell, not even in Russia. He's said to be close to President Putin, but I'm still trying to work out more. All I know is he's in his late 30s, and he's a billionaire.
Oh, a billionaire. Well, I guess that's the way the game's going. How much did Ken make out of the deal?
That we don't know either. But this is clearly going to affect our plans.
Well, you sound worried.
Well, I feel like we've woken up to the first atom bomb going off. Everything's changed, really, but it's not exactly clear how. I expect this Mr. Abramovich will be wanting to spend some money, and that'll affect the market for players. Depending on how much they choose to spend and where, it could force prices up for everyone.
But there have been big money owners before, though. Back in 95, Jack Walker at Blackburn practically bought the league, but it didn't last. Where's Blackburn now?
Well, they're nowhere, I agree. But Jack Walker didn't have billions of rubles to play with, though, David. We've never seen this type of money in the sport before.
Well, come what may, we are still Liverpool. We've got history on our side. And sure, there's going to be some players who'll be distracted by them waving money around. But I know plenty more would rather play for a team with soul.
The arrival of Roman Abramovich in the summer of 2003 transformed soccer, and Rick Perry was right to be worried. Within weeks of his takeover, Chelsea Football Club had bought 7 players for a combined £100 million. It was a spending spree unlike anything in English history, and Liverpool would be left playing catch-up. But David Moores and Rick Perry had their own work cut out, because in truth, Liverpool Football Club had been falling behind for years. When David Moores became chairman of Liverpool Football Club in August 1991, only a year had passed since the team last won the English League title. That did not seem a remarkable achievement at the time. During the 1970s and 80s, Liverpool had been the most dominant team in the land. In the 15 years between 1975 and 1990, it had won the First Division, the top English league, a remarkable 10 times. But just as David took the helm at Liverpool, soccer in England was about to undergo a radical shift. Ever since the Victorian era, all professional soccer teams in England had been part of the Football League. But by the early 1990s, the top English clubs had become frustrated with the power brokers in the league. So in 1992, the teams of the First Division, including Liverpool, decided to break away and form a new league they would run themselves. It became known as the Premier League. With this new league came new opportunities. Freed from the restrictions of the old system, the Premier League could sign its own sponsorship and broadcasting deals, and it soon agreed to a lucrative television contract with media tycoon Rupert Murdoch's network, Sky B. As recently as 1986, top-flight teams in England had earned just £50,000 a year from broadcasting, about $250,000 today. But this new 5-year deal with Sky B was worth over £300 million in total. And that meant each team in the Premier League would receive more than 30 times as much revenue from television as they had in the mid-80s. The deal changed soccer finances almost overnight. Money flooded into the sport as clubs embraced the growing opportunities in sponsorship and merchandising. David Moores and Liverpool were slow to take advantage, though. David was not a natural businessman. He had inherited his wealth and never built or led an organization before. So as the 1990s wore on, Liverpool began to drift. Other teams in England were not so slow-footed. For decades, Liverpool's most bitter foe had been Manchester United. The two teams were both located in the northwest of England, only 27 miles apart. But in the mid-90s, they seemed to exist in entirely different worlds. Manchester United had embraced the new commercialism of the age, building a vast megastore at its stadium to cater to the growing demand for team merchandise. By contrast, Liverpool's club shop was a small building tucked away in the corner of the stadium's parking lot, where staff sold key rings and souvenir mugs from behind a counter. Liverpool was outgunned financially. And in soccer, that meant usually being outgunned on the field as well, because the teams with the most money could buy the best players. Even David Moores could see that Liverpool was falling behind. So in June 1997, he recruited a new chief executive. Rick Perry was 42 years old and had been closely involved with the foundation of the Premier League. David hoped Rick would usher in a more modern approach at Liverpool. And under Rick's leadership, changes were made. Over the next few years, new commercial deals meant more investment in the team. Their outdated training complex was renovated, and Liverpool finally launched its own website, years after some of its rivals. But the biggest problem that Rick identified was Liverpool's stadium. Anfield was an old-fashioned arena, built up piecemeal over decades. It was atmospheric and beloved by fans, but it lacked many amenities, and its corporate facilities were limited. With every game Liverpool played there, they were losing financial ground on rivals with bigger, more modern, and more profitable stadiums. Redeveloping Anfield was a possibility, but David and Rick ultimately deemed it too difficult and too expensive. So instead, they would build an entirely new stadium in a nearby park. In May 2002, Rick Perry unveiled plans for a modern 55,000-seat arena. Its budget was modest, set around the equivalent of $150 million today. But that meant Liverpool hoped that construction would proceed quickly enough for the team to start playing in the new stadium by 2005. But before that could happen, the world of soccer would be turned on its head once again, and Liverpool would be left scrambling to keep up. Chelsea Football Club was another team that had not thrived in the new age of soccer. By the early 2000s, Chelsea was struggling financially, and there was speculation in the British press that the club would have to sell its best players just to survive. But then it found an unlikely savior. Practically overnight, in June 2003, a billionaire almost no one in England had ever heard of came to the rescue. Roman Abramovich had made his billions in oil and gas in the shady world of post-Soviet Russia. But success-starved Chelsea fans didn't seem to mind the source of his wealth when Abramovich started splashing the cash. Chelsea's investment in new players in the summer of 2003 was almost the equal of the other 19 clubs in the Premier League combined. And when Chelsea didn't win the league that year, Roman Abramovich simply shrugged and then spent even more. Liverpool and its chairman David Moyes simply couldn't compete with that. A more daring businessman might have decided to gamble at this point, to take out a loan to help the club construct its new stadium or buy better players. But other teams had tried that strategy in the past, and it had ended in disaster. If things went wrong, the club might struggle to repay its loans and even cease to exist. David was not willing to risk the future of Liverpool Football Club in this way. So reluctantly, he concluded the only solution was to sell. The thought of parting with Liverpool was heartbreaking for David. He had been a fan long before he became the club's chairman, but he also firmly believed that he was more a custodian than an owner. If there was someone better out there for Liverpool, it was his duty to find them. So in 2004, he instructed Liverpool's chief executive, Rick Perry, to start a search for new investors. Rick was confident that a club as famous as Liverpool wouldn't be short on suitors. For a year, he crisscrossed the globe, meeting with potential buyers, including Thaksin Shinawat, the billionaire prime minister of Thailand. He was willing to pay for Liverpool's new stadium in exchange for 30% of the club. But questions quickly arose over the human rights record of Shinawat's government, and Rick backed away. Rick was more hopeful about a deal with a consortium led by Robert Kraft. Kraft was the billionaire owner of the American football team, the New England Patriots. To David and Rick, Kraft seemed to be exactly the sort of man they were looking for. But this time, it was the suitor who backed away. Kraft decided that he couldn't give his all to a project on the other side of the Atlantic, and he wasn't the kind of man to do things half-heartedly. So as the summer of 2005 approached, it was a time of festering uncertainty and frustration at Liverpool. There was no sign of new investment in the club. Delays on the stadium project meant that Liverpool still hadn't even begun construction on its new home, and fans were increasingly worried by rumors that Chelsea was planning to buy Liverpool's captain and best player, local hero Steven Gerrard. But then, in May 2005, everything changed with one game. Rick Perry had done some business in Dubai in the past and had connections with the state-controlled company Dubai International Capital. DIC was the global investment arm of Dubai's multi-billion dollar sovereign wealth fund. Rick figured that if anyone had the resources to rival a Russian oligarch, it was a nation like Dubai. So as the 2005 Champions League final approached, Rick reached out to DIC and offered its chief executive Samir Al-Ansari a front row seat to the miracle of Istanbul. 2 weeks later, Al-Ansari asked to view Liverpool's books. DIC wanted to buy the club, build the new stadium, and fund an overhaul of the team. Rick and David were thrilled. Their long search for investment seemed to be over. But after this initial burst of excitement, negotiations would slow down. DIC was just one part of a tangled state bureaucracy in Dubai. As committees met and endless documents were passed back and forth, weeks and then months would pass. With no official offer emerging from the Middle East, David and Rick would begin to worry that they would never find an investor. But while DIC dithered, another suitor for Liverpool Football Club would emerge. It's November 2006, on a private jet winging its way across the Atlantic 18 months after Liverpool Football Club began negotiations with Dubai International Capital. Reclining in a leather seat, Liverpool FC's chairman and majority shareholder David Moores puffs happily on a cigar as a stewardess refills his drink.
You see, Rick, this is why I don't usually travel. Even in first class these days, you're not allowed to smoke.
You don't need to get yourself a private jet, David.
Well, maybe after all this, I can.
David and Liverpool CEO Rick Perry are on their way to meet with another prospective buyer of Liverpool Football Club. George Gillette is the owner of the ice hockey team, the Montreal Canadiens. The 67-year-old originally made his money in television and ski resorts, but now he sent his own private jet to pick David and Rick up from England and bring them to Canada.
And these Montreal Canadiens, they're an American football team? No, ice hockey. They're NHL, not NFL. All right. I find all these American sports very confusing. They probably say the same thing about us. Have you tried explaining cricket to an American?
David laughs as his eyes wander over the luxurious jet's cabin and the drink glass in his hand, monogrammed with George Gillette's initials.
You think this Gillette fella has the sort of money we need? I mean, for the stadium and the squad? Well, I don't know, to be honest with you. He does have an impressive track record in business, but not Roman Abramovich-style wealth. He had to declare bankruptcy back in the 90s. Bankruptcy? Yeah, that's what part of this trip is about, I think. He wants to show us that those days are behind him, that he knows how to run a sports team. So I expect he'll put on a bit of a show. My understanding is that Mr. Gillette is going to have us tour the entire operation, stadium, back office, everything. Well, I guess at the very least, we should be able to learn something, maybe pick up some ideas about how they do things.
Well, certainly true.
Then Rick leans forward and lowers his voice.
But what I'm really hoping for is that this trip will light a fire under our friends in Dubai.
Oh, a bit of healthy competition. Do they know about it?
I expect so. I might find a way to drop it into conversation next time we speak. I'm told there is a bid coming. But how long have they been saying that, though?
Well, precisely. But we've got this $12 million steel order for the new stadium. That needs to be placed in January, or construction will be pushed back again. And need I remind you, the club doesn't have $12 million to spare.
Neither do I.
I know, David. And that's why we have to get the deal with DIC over the line.
David raises his glass and smiles.
Well, if it takes a trip or two on a private jet to get it done, that's a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
On their trip across the Atlantic, David Moores and Rick Perry were left impressed by both George Gillette himself and his operation in Montreal. But they still doubted that George had the financial muscle needed for the deal. DIC remained their first choice, and a few weeks after their visit to Montreal, there was finally a breakthrough in negotiations. The threat of a rival bidder seemed to have done the trick. Liverpool Football Club was being sold to Dubai. On December 4th, 2006, Liverpool Football Club publicly confirmed that a deal had been agreed to in principle with Dubai International Capital. The agreement valued Liverpool at £156 million, about $450 million today. And DIC made guarantees that a further £200 million would be invested in new facilities and playing staff. Most analysts expected the deal to be finalized quickly. Liverpool fans began dreaming of the new players the club might buy and imagining the shiny new stadium that was surely, finally, about to start construction. But then, yet again, DIC delayed. Liverpool's majority owner David Moores and the club's CEO Rick Perry couldn't understand it. Dubai had been looking at Liverpool's books for 18 months by now. There was surely no need for yet more due diligence. And when quizzed on this latest delay, DIC chief Samir Al-Ansari informed Rick that the investment firm was still in discussions with its banks. But this also made no sense to Rick and David. DIC was supposed to be part of a multi-billion dollar sovereign wealth fund. It shouldn't have needed to go to a bank to fund this project. So with every passing day, David began to worry that he'd made the wrong decision. DIC was not as committed to Liverpool as he had thought. These concerns deepened only a few weeks later. At the end of December 2006, the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph released a leaked DIC investment document. It outlined DIC's plan to use borrowed money to buy Liverpool and then sell the club within 7 years for a vast profit. Publicly, DIC and Al-Ansari dismissed the document, suggesting it had been taken out of context. Rick Perry also continued to insist that the deal with Dubai was almost done. But behind the scenes, David Moores was horrified and angry. this leaked document looked legitimate. And it went against everything the executives at DIC had told him about becoming long-term partners. He feared he was handing the wrong people the keys to his kingdom. This news that the Liverpool deal with Dubai was in doubt soon filtered across the Atlantic, and George Gillette saw his opportunity. He'd kept in touch with David and Rick since their visit to Montreal, and he still thought he could beat DIC and snatch control of Liverpool Football Club. He just needed to find a partner with deeper pockets. So in the early days of 2007, George attended an NHL owners' conference. But he wasn't interested in hearing the latest updates in hockey. He wanted to discuss soccer, and there was only one man he wanted to speak to. 60-year-old Tom Hicks was the owner of the Dallas Stars hockey team. He also owned the Texas Rangers baseball team. He had a net worth of close to $1 billion, having become rich through his investment firm in the 80s and 90s. George didn't know Tom well, personally. But they had done some business together back in 2002, and George knew that Tom was both a man who liked buying sports teams and a man who was willing to take a gamble. Cornering him at the hockey conference, George made his pitch. He told Tom about a historic soccer team in England that could be bought relatively cheaply. It already had a global fan base and television broadcasting deals worth billions of dollars. But it was run by amateurs who didn't seem to realize the goldmine they were sitting on. If George and Tom were to pool their resources, they could buy the team and make themselves even richer. Tom listened and was intrigued. He went away to do some research, and as he looked into the world of English soccer for the first time, he realized that if anything, George Gillette had undersold Liverpool's potential. Tom was convinced they could easily make billions with this deal. And within 48 hours of meeting George at the hockey conference, Tom had made a decision. He was in. At the end of January 2007, Liverpool Football Club called a meeting of its board. To outsiders, it seemed that the deal with Dubai International Capital was finally about to be confirmed. But no one outside the room knew what was really on the agenda. Because by this point, David Moores and Rick Perry had received another offer. George Gillette and his new partner Tom Hicks were offering the modern equivalent of $500 million for Liverpool FC, 500 pounds more per share than Dubai's proposal. Now, David and the rest of Liverpool's shareholders had a decision to make. Over the past few months, David had come to like George Gillette. He felt George had been upfront and open, whereas DIC had been secretive and aloof. Admittedly, David didn't know much about Tom Hicks, but his financial advisors told him that Tom was certainly wealthy. He clearly had experience running sports teams, owning two of them, and he was well-connected politically, with close ties to U.S. President George W. Bush. Above all, though, what convinced David was that George Gillette said Tom Hicks could be trusted. So at the board meeting, it was all agreed to sell Liverpool to the Americans. But at the last minute, David hesitated. He had given his word to DIC, and they had shaken hands on a deal. That still meant something to David. The pressure was growing, he didn't know what to do and needed time to think. So the morning after the board meeting, David called Samir Al-Ansari, the chief executive of DIC. He explained the situation and said another offer had come in and now he had to choose, but he would make a definitive decision either way within 48 hours. Al-Ansari did not take this well. He'd heard rumors of the rival bid from America and wanted David to rule it out immediately. So Al-Ansari gave David a deadline. He needed to complete the deal with DIC by 5 p.m. that afternoon, or Dubai would walk away. David was outraged by the ultimatum and refused to be bullied into any decision. So that afternoon, DIC announced it was formally withdrawing its offer. After more than 18 months of talks, the deal with Dubai was dead, leaving the door open for George Gillette and Tom Hicks. These two men would walk right through it and be welcomed at Liverpool with open arms. Flashing big smiles and even bigger promises, George and Tom would be hailed as saviors of the historic sports team, bringing to Liverpool Football Club a new era. It's February 6th, 2007, at the Anfield Soccer Stadium in Liverpool, England.
George Gillette sneaks a look through a glass window into the Liverpool Football Club trophy room. Cabinets of glistening cups and awards assembled over the decades line the walls. In front of them, a table has been set up with microphones and jugs of water. And beyond that, a crowd of reporters and photographers awaits. With a twinkling grin, George turns to his new business partner and co-owner of the Liverpool Football Club, Tom Hicks.
Well, looks like they're expecting a bit of a show, Tom.
Both Tom and George are wearing matching gray suits with Liverpool red ties, but that's where the resemblance ends. Tom is a tall, thick-set man who towers over the diminutive George. And where George is all smiles and jokes, Tom is cold-eyed and serious.
Well, if they're expecting fireworks, they're in for a disappointment. Well, we've only got to keep it respectful. This is about winning and passion, tradition and all that. We're not here just for the money. Well, speak for yourself, George. How long have we got?
George glances at his watch.
A few minutes still.
Tom pulls a piece of paper from his pocket.
And what's that?
George peers over as Tom unfolds it. A print-off of a Wikipedia article on the history of Liverpool Football Club.
Oh, last-minute cramming. I don't think there's going to be a quiz.
No, but this is a test. Every one of them in that room will be judging us. What we say, how we sound. So if some smart-ass reporter asks me a question about what happened here in 1948 or whatever, I want to know the answer. But Tom, they know we're not soccer people. I don't think we should pretend that we are. We've just got to come across as genuine in our intentions.
Tom doesn't answer and keeps studying his fact sheet. George glances back at the door through the trophy room.
Which one of us should talk first, do you think? I mean,
I'll go first.
Well, you know, I've been dealing with Rick and Dave longer. I'm the one who put the deal together.
Tom looks up from his sheet and gives George a cold stare. George just grins nervously.
Well, you know what? It doesn't matter. Go ahead. Go first.
I think that would be best.
Finally, the door to the trophy room opens, and Liverpool's chief executive, Rick Perry, steps inside. He gives George and Tom a nod, indicating it's time. Tom folds away his fact sheet, and George is almost hopping from foot to foot with excitement.
Well, Tom, this is it.
He gestures to the open door and the reporters and photographers waiting for them.
After you.
Tom lays a heavy hand on George's shoulder.
No, partner, I insist. After you.
For the first time in its history, the most successful soccer team in England was owned by foreigners. The deal had made George Gillette and Tom Hicks co-chairmen of Liverpool Football Club, with each man owning a 50% stake. They were all smiles and laughter at the press conference as they proposed increased investment and that work on Liverpool's long-delayed stadium would begin within 60 days. The sun was shining over Anfield, and the future looked bright. George Gillette and Tom Hicks admittedly did not know much about soccer. So at first, they prioritized continuity with the old regime. The former chairman and majority shareholder David Moores was appointed to the board in an honorary position as life president of the club. Rick Perry would remain as chief executive, and the popular Rafael Benitez would be retained as the team's manager. By this stage, the new owners had already met with Liverpool's players and turned on the charm, promising investment on and off the field. But it was Liverpool's fans who needed the most reassurance. They had been left bewildered by the events of early 2007. They entered the year entertaining visions of a glorious future where the endless wealth of Dubai enabled Liverpool to compete with rivals like Manchester United and Chelsea. But within weeks, that dream had evaporated. And now suddenly, two unknown Americans were taking seats in the boardroom instead. So in the days after George and Tom's takeover was confirmed, Liverpool embarked on a swift PR campaign. The team's most influential players were wheeled out to express their approval of the new owners. And the local newspaper, the Liverpool Echo, splashed its front page with an endorsement from Rafael Benitez, who said that the soccer team was in good hands. Off the record, Liverpool officials briefed reporters that dealing with DIC had been a nightmare, with long delays as committees met and approvals were sought. Now, though, Liverpool would be dealing with just two owners, two men who knew sports, knew business, and knew how to triumph in both. This propaganda campaign seemed to work. At one of the first games following the sale, a homemade banner appeared in the stands at Anfield. Painted in white on a red sheet were words playing on a famous MasterCard advertising slogan. It read, "Match ticket, £32. New Anfield, £220 million. Rafa Benitez, priceless. For everything else, there's George and Tom."
But in truth, the new owners were very much pushing against an open door. Liverpool fans wanted to believe what they were being told. That's partly what made soccer such an attractive industry to men like George Gillette and Tom Hicks. Soccer fans were a captive audience of consumers. A disgruntled fan was not going to start supporting a rival if ticket prices got too high or they were overcharged for soda. They'd keep coming back year after year, or so George and Tom hoped. Because the two men knew they had to find ways to extract more money from their fans. Liverpool's revenues for the previous year had reached £122 million, but that was still almost 40% lower than what was recorded by Manchester United. And that gap looked only set to widen. Manchester United was on track to add another 8,000 seats to its stadium, taking the capacity to a mammoth 76,000. Liverpool had to catch up, and George Gillette and Tom Hicks had made a commitment to finally begin work on the club's new stadium. That would introduce additional revenue streams, but construction would take years. In the meantime, George and Tom were determined to overhaul Liverpool's commercial operations, which, despite Rick Perry's best efforts, were still lagging behind the competition. Still, as spring approached in 2007, there was optimism in the air at Liverpool Football Club. On the field, Rafa Benitez was steering the team toward another Champions League final. Off the field, Liverpool's long search for outside investment had finally come to an end. The 115-year-old club had new owners who would invest new money in new facilities and new players, who spoke of being custodians of a precious institution that they wanted to pass down to their children one day. But there was a problem with these and all of George and Tom's other promises. None of them were true. From Wondery, this is episode 1 of Liverpool FC in the Red for Business Movers. On the next episode, cracks emerge in the partnership between George Gillette and Tom Hicks, plunging Liverpool Football Club into chaos. If you'd like to learn more about Liverpool and soccer finances, we recommend An Epic Swindle, 44 Months with a Pair of Cowboys by Brian Reed, Done Deal by Daniel G., and The Billionaire Club by James Montagu. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Mohamed Shazi. Sound design by Molly Bond. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by William Simpson. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Aaron O'Flaherty, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marshall Louie for Wondering.